podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Security Now is provided by AOL Radio at AOL.com/podcasting. This is Security Now with Steve Gibson, episode 101 for July 19th, 2007. Are you human? Time to talk about security, everybody's favorite subject. Well, maybe not everybody.
Well, certainly, what, about 150,000,
something like that. Yeah, all the people who listen to this podcast. Anyway, we're so glad you're here. Steve Gibson is here from GRC.com, the able man behind SpinRite, the disk recovery and maintenance utility that we talk about all the time, and all those free programs like Securable. You know, somebody told me, we're going to talk a little bit about Are You Human, which will be fun, but somebody told me that one antivirus...
It's AVG, Leo, and it is driving us out of our mind.
It's a false positive, right?
Of course. And it has happened with my security stuff from time to time that AV software will get tripped over my programs, because very often the same sort of code sequences
right.
that I'm using to check something about security or to turn something off or on, that'll naturally be the same sort of references that malware would have for doing the same sort of thing, but for its own malicious purposes. So it's incredibly annoying. Greg has been getting, my support guy, has been getting flooded with literally hundreds of reports. Hey, you got a virus in Securable, or, you know, AVG pops. It's like,
no.
No.
Yeah, I've only gotten one, and of course that's what I said. These are false positives. They do. It's not just Steve's software. It happens in other programs, too, and antivirus companies do their best to avoid them, but there's inevitably some overlap, and that's what happens.
So for what it's worth, if we have any listeners who have and use AVG and get a false positive for Securable, I would love it if you could put some pressure on AVG to, like, fix their program, their virus patterns, to remove Securable from their list through whatever means they have for doing that.
We probably have a very high percentage of AVG users listening to the show. I don't know if that's because they're cheapskates or what.
Well, no, smart.
Smart. They don't want to spend money on an antivirus, and AVG is good enough. They know what to do to keep themselves clean anyway, so that's all they need.
Exactly.
That makes sense. Good. I'm glad we got that out of the way. And let's get a couple of more letters from the mailbag. Do you have any addenda, too, we should talk about before?
I do. I wanted to announce, since we're going to be now doing we're getting a little more complex with our mathematical formulas, Leo. We're going to have the Mod 4 plus 2 episodes are going to be mailbag episodes.
That's next episode, then.
Exactly. That'll be 102 will be the first mailbag episode. I wanted to give people an alternative way, an easier way for sending stuff to me. At the moment, all I've ever talked about is having the web form down at the bottom of the Security Now page.
Right.
Actually, however, that web form has always simply done an email to securitynow@grc.com with no exclamation point.
Right.
So anyone who wants to just, you know, send feedback about Security Now issues, you can write to securitynow@grc.com, and it'll come right to me. I did the web form initially because I really wanted to stress that people were welcome to be completely anonymous. And, of course, a web form rather than someone's web browser – I mean, sorry, rather than someone's email client is an easier way to anonymize yourself, which I wanted to promote. But for people who don't care, and we, of course, have lots of people who are, you know, happy to acknowledge their listenership, you can certainly just use your email client and write to securitynow@grc.com.
securitynow@grc.com. All right.
Okay.
That'll qualify you for the mailbag, but no guarantees.
Exactly.
All right.
Okay. Something else very cool happened in the last week. Started with something not so cool. About 2 weeks ago, I was at Starbucks using my T-Mobile account and my laptop to piddle around the net doing whatever I was doing. And I think I did something with PayPal that upset it. And because later that day or the next day or something, I tried to do something from home, and it said, "Oh, we flagged your account for alert status. We think somebody was trying to hack into your account, so you have to jump through these 9 hoops in order to." And it was about 9. I mean, it was like, "Oh, what is all this?" I mean, I had to go through all kinds of, you know, rigmarole to pacify them. Of course, I got freaked out that maybe somebody really was trying to hack my account. But I looked at the date and I said, "Wait a minute, you know, I think yesterday at Starbucks I did this. You know, I was the one that was, quote, hacking my own account when, you know, just who knows why, what I did to set it off." But the point is, I discovered that PayPal has full multi-factor authentication. I now have exactly one of these cool 6-digit numeric token pieces of hardware from Secure ID. Get this, for $5.
I should do that right now.
Everybody should do that. I wanted to let everybody know who uses PayPal that you can get a secure key from PayPal. If you just log into your account, over on the left, you'll see secure key.
That's great.
It only $5.
You know, we use PayPal for donations. And I get every week or so somebody says, "I can't do it. I'm not going to do it. I don't trust PayPal. I've had bad experiences and so forth and so on." But I have to say, PayPal, especially since eBay bought them, has completely turned around and refocused. And I think people should give them a little second chance.
Well, I have
things
heard,
like this, I mean, very impressive.
Well, it's very cool. Now, I have heard of, as I'm sure you have too, Leo, of horror stories with PayPal. They have sort of the flavor of, well, everything's great until it goes bad, and when
right.
they go bad, it goes really bad.
Right.
So, you know, who knows? But for people who use PayPal, who are listeners to Security Now, who care about the security of, you know, their use of computers, I wanted to say, hey, for first of all, you don't even have to authorize the key. You can buy it for $5 and just have this very cool dongle, which, I mean, it's neat. It's got a button.
Now, I'm looking at my PayPal account. I'm wondering if that's because you had this problem, because this is on the front page of PayPal. I don't see it.
No, you have to log into your account.
Yeah.
And then over on the left-hand column, it says secure key.
I don't have that.
I think that's what it says.
I don't have that. So I wonder if that's because at some point you...
I don't think so. I got the sense that it was...
I'm trying to think. Well, let me do a search. I'm on the new PayPal. Maybe if I go back to the original PayPal site, it'll be that way. You know, we use PayPal quite heavily. We have a lot of money going through our PayPal account, and I'd really very much like to secure it in any way we can.
I got the strong sense that anybody who wants to do this can. And as I was saying, you don't have to follow through and attach it to your account. You could just have it as this very cool secure ID dongle for $5.
Right.
And so you press the button, it gives you a 6-digit number, and exactly as we were talking about, every 30 seconds, it will lock that number on the display, but if you press the button to turn it off and then press it again to turn it back on, and if you've crossed another one of these 30-second boundaries, you get a completely different 6 digits. Then once you add this to your account, you know, they mail it to you, it takes about 10 days, a week to 10 days, you then, basically you use it to authenticate yourself to prove that you have logged on and you received the key. And then the way it works from then on is you simply append those 6 digits to your password.
Wow.
So it creates an always varying, never the same one twice, and a multi-factor authentication, because you have to actually have this in your possession. And once you've done that, then if you lose it or don't have it with you or whatever, then you got to jump through even more hoops to prove to them that, you know, you are who you are, because they want to make sure that, you know, you, again, you're that your account is hardened against anyone taking advantage of that.
Well, that's cool. I'm glad to see
that they... But still can't find it?
No. I'll find
it. Shoot. I think it's there somewhere, so...
I believe you. I'll find it. It'll be here somewhere.
Okay. Also, we have to talk about a book you turned me on to.
Uh-oh. You know, it's fun. Because Audible's sponsoring... by the way, Audible is not sponsoring Security Now for one reason only, and because I said they couldn't. Because we already have two commercials on Security Now, and I never want to have more than two on any podcast. They very much wanted to be on Security Now because they know we talk about books all the time. But that's one of I think one of the most fun things about this Audible thing is that we've been talking about books on all of the podcasts, and I know which one you're going to talk about, and it was one of our early picks, and it's just great. So you liked it.
Well, I'm not through with it yet, Leo, but I am really having fun with this book. First of all, I had a couple experiences. The book is titled On Intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
On Intelligence is the title, by Jeff Hawkins, mm-hmm. who, as a Palm follower as I am, I knew the name immediately, and I can't wait to get his new Palm gizmo, the Folio, because I think for me that'll be a really nice add-on to my trio. But I've been a Palm user forever. Jeff is the inventor of graffiti, the designer of the whole family of Palm things. He then created Handspring, where, of course, the trio was born, and then that all merged.
You love your trio, too.
Of my trio.
Yeah.
So it turns out that Jeff Hawkins has always had, for his whole life, a strong interest in brain function, how the brain works.
Yeah.
Well, nobody knows it, but I have always had that, too. I mean, back in high school, I read everything I could about neurons and synapses and axons and all that. And so what gives me goosebumps is that here he is, who, basically an engineer, a computer guy, who's been successful in Silicon Valley, who has now founded a company, I think it's Numenta, to work on creating intelligent machines. And so this book, and the reason I'm talking about it is even though I'm not finished with it, I'm about, I think, maybe somewhere between a third and a halfway through, what I've read already allows me to commend it to our listeners. It is just riveting.
Yeah.
So if anyone is interested in sort of having a contemporary, easy to read, really engaging look at what we currently know about intelligence and how our brain functions at the cellular level, and from Jeff's standpoint, you know, why it is that AI has failed, how things function. As I was saying to you, Leah, before we began recording, I almost don't want to talk about it too much because I don't want to be a spoiler for what the book has in it. But I really, really like the book. So it's funny too, because I have it in both Sony e-reader and in Palm e-book, and I have a physical copy that I got because I have a friend, actually it was my second employee at GRC, who's a gifted hardware engineer and software guy who ended up leaving because I just didn't have enough to keep him busy. I'm glad because I, kicked him out of the nest, and I was the first job he ever had. And he and I had actually worked together years before on the light pen stuff.
Oh, interesting.
He did some light pen work for me. Anyway, I'm going to have lunch with him and give him this book and probably seriously damage his life.
Why is that?
Because he's gonna read this, and he's gonna have a hard time remembering what it was he was doing before he started reading this book. I mean,
Is he in this field?
Yeah. Actually, he went into gaming, where he's won awards and started companies and sold them and done a lot. His name is Steve Rank. He's just one of the brightest, sharpest, neatest engineers I've ever known. And Steve will, it's going to be hard for him not to have to go build an intelligent brain.
Good.
After, oh, I know. And in fact, you know, that's sort of what Jeff is promoting and soliciting.
Yeah, you get to the end of the book, one of the things he says in the epilogue is, if you are a high school student reading this, please make this your field. This is where we want to go. We need this.
Yeah, I mean, there is... The book is just so full of stuff. One of the cool things is, you know, I mean, we all have a brain, pretty much.
Some of us.
And
some
and
don't.
There's enough new stuff in here that as I'm reading it, I'm thinking, oh, yeah, I never really thought about it that way, but that's exactly right. And, I mean, again, I it's just On Intelligence is the book. You can get it. As we know from you, Leo, in Audible format if you want to listen to it. You can get it in Sony Reader format if you want to play with the e-ink reader that you and I are both using, or in Palm, or, you know, e-reader. You can run, you can read it on Windows, because, of course, there is e-reader for Windows. And the physical paper format is also accessible. I should mention that I got it in also back on my Palm because I wanted to try falling back from the Sony to the Palm that I was using so extensively for years, and I decided I can't.
Oh, interesting.
Yes. I was... I picked it up on the Sony, and I found myself frustrated by the low contrast of that screen.
I know.
And that's the problem with...
Really got to do something about that.
Yeah, that's the problem. And it's like... Gosh darn it, you know, I mean, the Palm screen is just vivid black and white, and of course you have a backlight, so it's really bright white, because right. I read inverted. I read white text on a black screen on the Palm and love that, but the problem is now I can't have a smaller screen.
Oh, interesting.
You know, the e-ink, the Sony screen is so much nicer and more page size that it's even worth tolerating the lower resolution. I'm sorry, the lower contrast of that medium.
The contrast is bugging me, though. I have to agree with you. I can't wait till they get a paper white screen. Then that's a product that I would. I mean, already, right? It's a good product, and I've been reading a lot of books on it. But I just my eyes as I get older, I need more contrast. I really.
That's not just your age, Leo. Well, actually, I guess maybe we're the same age.
No, so. We're the same age. Yeah. So we maybe younger people don't have this issue. I don't know.
I did notice also when I went back to Sony to poke around to see whether On Intelligence was available from their from the Sony Kinect site that the price has fallen on the e-reader. I think it was $3-something and it's now $2.99. It might have been $3.49. Anyway, it has had a price reduction, which to me sort of speaks of maybe they weren't selling so well.
Yeah, no, I'm sure they're not. Despite how much we've talked about it.
Yeah,
it's too expensive. It's not quite the technology it needs to be yet.
Yep.
But we're early adopters, you know.
Okay, mailbag. I got two pieces of interestingly related mail. Remember Justin Gerard, the neat 13-year-old kid who had somebody from an outside service come in to fix his computer and discovered that they were using SpinRite. And I don't remember if he was going to try to get his dad to buy him a copy or what. But I found a note from him saying, "Hey, Steve, I found out that Nintendo has partnered with Astaro to provide optional content filtering via a proxy for the Nintendo DS web browser. Just thought you might like to know." And apparently Justin, by the way, has a podcast called Gamer's Edge Podcast.
Oh, I know that podcast. Okay.
Well, that's Justin. Yeah.
I'll be darned. All right.
And then we also got a note from Terry. It looks like Terry Sheltra of Charlottesville, and who writes, "I just thought you'd like I would share something interesting with you with the two of us about the new Nintendo DS browser. Included in the package is an insert that offers content filtering provided by none other than Astaro, free of charge. Since they're a big sponsor for your podcast, I thought I'd share the news with you."
So that wouldn't mean that they put Astaro on the DS.
No, it would mean that there's a proxy server that Nintendo is offering people can route their web browser, their Nintendo DS web browsers through, and Astaro is the content filtering and protection technology that Nintendo chose.
Makes perfect sense. That's what I choose. But, of course, I'm a little biased. All right, so that's the mailbag out of the way. Remember, again,
almost. I got one last little blurb here. David Lee, who's an MCP small business specialist in Ottawa, Canada, he wrote to me with a little fun blurb about Spinrite, and I bring it up because he asked two questions, one of which I hear a lot, so I wanted to answer it on behalf of, you know, our listeners who are now Spinrite users in case you encounter this. He says, well, his subject was, "Hello, Steve and Leo, another testimonial to hitch to your belt." And he said, "I've been an owner of Spinrite for about a year now, and have used it a few times to improve performance on my machines, but until yesterday had not had any catastrophic failures from which to recover. Enter the BSOD, you know, the blue screen of death. Upon rebooting after installing Adobe 8.1 Reader update, my laptop provided me with the gut-wrenching unbootable drive message. Neither safe mode nor last good configuration boot options would work either. Knowing I had Spinrite in my, quote, back pocket, unquote, however, gave me some immediate comfort in the knowledge there was a better than good chance it would get me back up and running. I ran it on level 2, and 45 minutes later, friends, on my one-year-old Fujitsu 80-gig 2.5-inch drive, it was stuck on an obviously bad area of the drive. With a couple of red U's on the screen, I had confirmation the issue was hardware-related, as I had suspected. I left it to run overnight and am writing to you this message from my now-working laptop." So, you know, success. Thank you. And then he says, two questions for you. First, what is the best practice for replacing drives that exhibit unrecovered data errors?
That's a great question, because we talk about recovering these drives and say, everybody says, oh, we're working along and it's just fine. But it always makes me queasy if they had a problem before. Should you keep using that drive?
Exactly. He says, in your Spinrite episode on Security Now, this was not addressed, i.e., should a drive that has had these types of errors be replaced ASAP? Or, with the sectors now marked as bad, is it likely safe to continue using for the foreseeable future?
Right.
Anticipating a couched response to this, he says...
couched!
And there's a little smiley face here. What would you do if it was your hard drive,
he said. No couching, Steve. I want you to say it out. Sing it out.
Well, there are a couple reasons that Spinrite will give you a red U.
Right.
And we can divide it into two categories. First of all, the U means that no matter what Spinrite tried to do, and I mean, it will sit there and crunch on a sector for a long time, it was never able to completely recover the sector's data. Now, that can be a defective sector, which should normally not surface on the drive, or it could be one that was miswritten, for example. If the drive lost power during a write, then you will cause an unrecoverable sector to be created.
Because is it a head crash or?
Well, no, it's not a head crash. It's just that it never had a chance to finish writing the sector and update the error correction code, the ECC, which is sort of like a very powerful checksum. And so it just sort of half wrote the sector. And so no matter when you then run Spinrite over it, no matter what Spinrite tries, it cannot get this sector recovered. It says, look, there's nothing I can do to tell you what this data is supposed to be, because in this case, it was, you know, only half written. So that doesn't necessarily mean that the drive is having a problem. Now, another non-power failure event can occur, which is that, in general, defects grow over time. And as anyone who's looked at the videos that you and I and that I and Patrick Norton made, where I was on yours and Screensavers TV show showing Spinrite work, drives are doing data recovery sort of silently all the time. So-called error correction code is being employed constantly because the data densities have gotten so high on our drives that it's no longer the case that sectors read perfectly. So what happens is the drive is making corrections just because there's just the density is so high, but the drive is watching how long the error bursts are. That is, if it's a few bits, the drive's like, eh, okay, fine, this sector's still okay. But over time, these tend to grow. And so what happens is that at a certain point, a threshold is reached where the drive becomes uncomfortable with its continuing future ability to perform on-the-fly correction of this sector. And so what it'll do at that point is it will get a correct read that is correct the errors in the sector and autonomously remove that sector from service, swapping a spare into its place, and then rewrite the data that it correctly read back onto the swapped in spare sector. So what can happen if you don't allow the drive to see given sectors often enough, you haven't given the drive the chance to recognize that some sectors are approaching its tolerance of its ability to correct them, which is one of the reasons that just running SpinWrite at level 2, which is a relatively quick read pass, essentially what that does is that gives that forces the drive to read all of its sectors. And even though SpinWrite won't show you that it did anything good, and this is one of the sort of the dilemmas, the mixed blessings of using SpinWrite, is people will run it all the time and they'll go, well, you know, I've never had a drive give me any problems, and I run SpinWrite every few months, but I don't know that it's really doing any good. Well, one of the reasons they've never had a problem is that SpinWrite is actually letting the drive assess its own sectors and swap them out before they become problematical. So if someone didn't do that, they might find that SpinWrite would show them a red uncorrectable sector because the sector had gone too long without being read, so the drive wasn't able to say, whoops, this is getting to be problematical. I can still read it but barely. So while I can and while I can read it and correct it, I'm going to swap in something that's in better shape. So that's all sort of going on behind the scenes. And then the third and final problem is drives can run out of spares. And at that point, if you actually have a defect which is not readable and there's no spares left for the drive to use, it has no choice but to just say, sorry, here's a problem sector, and I'm out of spares. And that does happen. So at that point, you certainly would want to say bye-bye to that drive.
Okay. But how can you tell that?
Well, running SpinWrite a second time after you've had – once SpinWrite gives up on a sector, marks it as uncorrectable, shows it that way, it will then rewrite the sector with – whatever data it was able to recover. That's why I don't give up easily. I try 2,000 times. Well, I and the guys of SpinWrite, 2,000 times and use every trick in the book, moving the head different distances in each direction and then coming back at it so that I'm arriving in slightly different positions. Do all kinds of things to really, really try to read that sector. When I finally can't, after 2,000 attempts, I will rewrite the sector with what I was able to read. And then that process fixes its unreadability and then allows the drive to maintain it from there on. But if you then run SpinWrite a second time and you've still got a problem, that means the drive was not able to even correct from a correctly written sector, and it's time to take the drive out of use before it really goes belly up.
So you didn't couch too bad on that one. The bottom line is that there is some slack in all drives and some room for error, but when it gets to the end of that rope, that's when you have to replace the drive.
Yeah, actually, I would say a lot of slack and a room for a lot
of
error.
There's no drive made that doesn't have some problems.
Not anymore, unfortunately.
Yeah.
And then his second question, which I got a kick out of, was, why hasn't anyone bought your company?
Security Now, you mean?
No, bought GRC or bought Spinrite. And he says, a la the old Chrysler commercials, quote, I was so impressed, I bought the company.
I bet you've had offers.
Well, Peter Norton offered to buy Spinrite shortly after I created it, about a year and a half later, I think. He said, Steve, I've got the Norton Utilities. Everybody I talk to just wants me to add Spinrite capability to our stuff. I want to buy it from you. And the best thing I ever said to Peter was, no thanks, Pete.
Yeah. This is your life's work.
Yeah, so far.
Sell your life's work.
So far.
On the other hand, everybody has a price. Somebody came along and offered you $1 billion. You might take it.
Yeah. I'd still do the podcast with you, however, Leo.
I would hope so. Because at that point, you could do it from your yacht.
In the Caribbean.
Exactly. Yeah.
And I'd create my own satellite network so that we had low latency.
All right. Let's get to the meat and potatoes of our discussion today. And
I forgot what we're talking about.
Are you human?
Oh, that's right.
Are you human?
What I love about this is that this is a type of authentication other than what we've talked about before. Of course, we've really clearly covered the issue of, are you a specific human? That is, the multi-factor authentication, like what we were talking about earlier with PayPal and so forth, was which human are you? And so what I like about this is that this is not who you are. This is, are you a who?
Okay, are you a who?
Are you a who?
Sounds like a Dr. Seuss story somehow.
Exactly. It's not who you are. It's are you a who?
And that's important because...
Well, what we've had, of course, is the rise of the Internet robots.
Yeah.
Back in the early days of the Internet, there were just people, using web browsers and using services and things. But what began to happen was... We introduced probably, I guess, the first real instance was free email accounts. It became clear that it was possible to do browser-based email, where companies like Yahoo, who may have been the pioneer of web mail, they said, hey, you can create an account, and it'll be, SusieJones@Yahoo.com or whatever, just to make up a name. I hope Susie... forgives me from using her email
address.
She's
probably pretty used to it by now.
With a
name like that.
And so that hit, everyone said, hey, this is cool. Then I don't have to be at my computer. I don't have to use an email client. Any web browser anywhere, I can log on to my email account and, check my mail and send stuff. Well, the bad guys, the spammers said, yes, and so can we. We can create endless email accounts at Yahoo with random names or made-up names or names composed of words in dictionaries or whatever, and use it to send our spam, because who would know that, that we were spam? And that way, the beauty is this was back in the early days where we had the blacklisting of spam servers. So the problem was those servers that were blacklisted could no longer send spam with sufficient reliability because they were becoming known. But by using Yahoo sort of as their third party, as their intermediary, using the web interface, they were able to cause Yahoo to be a spam forwarder. And so that's what happened. So, and then of course, even more recently, now with all of this web 2.0 stuff, now there's so much more. This whole notion, and we've talked about it with regard, for example, to cross-site scripting vulnerabilities and various problems associated with accepting input from users. Now, the web is much more bidirectional than ever before, with Facebook and MySpace and all the blogging that's going on. And one of the newest trends you see are articles online that then want feedback from readers. They have, posting comments at the end of articles. And so what's happened then is that if high-profile sites like, you know, NBC and ABC and CNN and so forth, that is, sites that are highly ranked in search engines, spammers will now, that is to say, website spammers will want to put their own links into blogs and into comments, because then search engines will say, oh, look, here's a highly ranked site that has a reference to this other site, which turns out to be a yucky site that people really don't want to know about, but that's a way of them elevating themselves in search engine rankings. So, you know, it's the same story as like virus, antivirus, and, you know, malware, anti-malware, spyware, anti-spyware. There are, you know, useful services that have unfortunately been abused by people on the dark side who have said, hey, you know, we can pretend to be human and abuse the system in various ways. So,
but they can't prove that they're human if you can come up with a scheme.
Yes, what's really interesting is that the first time I encountered this notion of needing to prove that I'm human, it's like, oh, what an interesting kind of cool problem.
Right.
And your first thought, my first thought, you know, as a computer guy, and, you know, any of us are to some degree, well, to probably a complete degree, computer users, any user sort of thinks, huh, how would I solve this problem? And at first it doesn't seem to be such a hard problem. It's like, well, it's got to be easy to figure out the difference between a computer and a human. But it turns out it's less easy than people might think, because so much of the sorts of things that are feasible to do, computers can be programmed to get around. So this notion of some way to solve this problem turns out to actually have a deep history, which is sort of interesting. There was something known as the Turing test, T-U-R-I-N-G, which was originally proposed by an early researcher in computers named Alan Turing, who was also the father, in some senses, of modern computing, or at least of algorithms.
He also helped crack Enigma, the German code-breaking device.
Yes,
device,
exactly. He worked at Bletchley Place, or is it Plaza or Place? Bletchley Place.
Yeah.
Over in England, and was involved in the code breaking of the German Enigma code during World War II. And he was recognized at a young age as being a genius.
Brilliant guy.
He really is regarded as that. He tackled the question of computability. That was, what did it mean for something to be computable? And that is to have like an algorithmic solution. And in fact, he formally laid down this notion of an algorithm, and the formalization of it took the form of something called a Turing machine, which he formally proposed and laid out in a paper that he wrote early on.
Couldn't be built at the time in the 40s.
Well, and in fact, it's more of a theoretical machine.
Right.
I mean, people have built them for fun, but the idea of a Turing machine is that it sort of using the jargon...
Bletchley Park, by the way.
Bletchley Park. Oh, that's right. Park,
yeah.
Right. Using the concepts at the time, the idea of Alan's Turing machine was that you'd have a paper tape which was theoretically infinite in length. It had a starting place, but it never ended, because, you know, this thing, in order to do useful work, might have to have a very long tape, because the idea was that it was a series of very simple steps. And basically you had a read head that was positioned at some location on the tape, and each cell in the tape could contain only a one or a zero, so he had this notion of binariness back then. And and the machine also had some state, so it had a well-defined state which was, you know, not specified, but it was, you know, just some number of bits or something that defined the current state. And the way he defined it was you had the current position of the head, which was able to read or write to a one or a zero to the cell, and then cause the tape to move to the left or the right, and change the state, that is, update the state to, state plus one. And, that was the definition of this machine. And he managed, through a series of very careful mathematical proofs, to show that this machine could solve any problem that any computer could solve. And in fact, there was something known as the...
At the time, a computer was a human.
Exactly.
It was a woman, usually, who was doing computations. So he's
right.
Talking about a machine that replaces a human computer, basically.
Right. And then there was this notion of the UTM, the Universal Turing Machine, where he said, okay, you could define a machine on the tape, which on the tape would then be followed by a problem. And so this created this notion of a universal Turing machine, because you could use it as like a universal emulator for any other machine. So, he basically said, okay, this is how computers can be simplified, down to this. Well, amid all of this, actually toward the end of his life, which wasn't very long, unfortunately, he only didn't quite make it to the age of 42. So he was quite prolific during his first 41 years. He ended up saying, okay, thinking about intelligence, how can we determine if a machine is intelligent? How do we define intelligence? And he had early 1950s definition. He said, and this was the so-called Turing test. He said, if you put a human in one room and a machine in another, and you ask them both questions, that is, a human being asks both of them questions, but doesn't know which room contains the human and which room contains the machine, that is to say, the AI, the artificial intelligence, if the person asking the questions cannot reliably determine which room contains which entity, then that is said to pass the Turing test for determining whether this is a machine or a human. So again, it's a sort of a thought experiment. It's a simple formulation for asking the question, but that's deep in the history of computing.
A couple of footnotes on that. On intelligence, he'll talk about, you haven't gotten there yet, but he talks about the Turing test and why it's essentially will never be solved. That's kind of, in some ways, the premise of On Intelligence.
Well, I think he also talks about John Searle's Chinese Room.
Yes,
thought experiment also.
Yeah.
Anyway, there's a bunch of stuff in this book that I really recommend to our listeners. So,
a second footnote before you go on. Appropriate to mention, and it's very sad that he, in fact, committed suicide after being prosecuted for being gay.
I know.
And it's just a great tragedy. I won't belabor it, but read the article on Wikipedia about Alan Turing's life, and there's some excellent books on Turing, and he actually appears in Cryptonomicon, another favorite book of ours.
Yes, he does. Right, I forgot about that.
Yeah, that's Bletchley Park is a big part of that whole book. So, but anyway, so that Turing test is the first case of a challenge, human-machine challenge, I guess.
Well, it is, and it bears on what we're talking about, because the rather lengthy acronym for the whole class of currently most popular approaches to differentiating people from computers, that is, who you are or are you a who, it involves this Turing test phrase. What happened is about 7 years ago, in 2000, Carnegie Mellon University, a researcher there, Lewis Von Ahn, and for Elaine's sake, who's transcribing this, Von Ahn is two words, V-O-N, and the second word is A-H-N. He got serious about CAPTCHAs, and actually that's their acronym, and believe it or not, Carnegie Mellon has a trademark on the word CAPTCHA.
Really? It's an acronym?
It's an
C-A-P-T-C-H-A. I always thought it was just capture mispronounced.
But well, get this. The CAPTCHA stands for Completely Automated Public Turing Test to Tell Computers and Humans Apart.
I'll be danged. So Alan Turing is memorialized in the CAPTCHA.
Yes, and now people know, if anyone has the, you know, the memory to remember Completely Automated Public Turing Test to Tell Computers and Humans Apart, now you know what a Turing test is,
right,
and who Turing was,
right, right,
who came up with this test. So that's what CAPTCHA stands for, and the university, CMU, has a trademark, which they're obviously, you know, not being jealous about. I'm sure they trademarked it so that, you know, because they had come up with it, they thought it was cool, and they wanted, you know, some credit for it, but not to prevent others from using the word, because it's widely used, and no one seems to be, you know,
right,
no one from CMU seems to be causing any upset about that. So the most familiar CAPTCHAs, and I would imagine by this point, everyone around, that is to say, everyone listening to this podcast, has encountered some. You and I have, in fact, talked about them from time to time briefly in prior podcasts, Leo, where there are these wacky-looking images where you are asked to basically decipher a warped and deliberately obscured chunk of text or letters and numbers or something. You're asked basically to solve some sort of problem, the idea being that this is something that would be easy for humans and hard for computers. Well, it turns out that computers have gotten so good that in order for it to be hard for computers, unfortunately, more often than not, it also has to be hard for people.
Right, unfortunately, yeah.
And, you know, and I mean, I have encountered CAPTCHAs, you know, visual CAPTCHAs, that I have not been able to properly enter the, you know, the proper code for, which is, you know, really annoying. You know,
I do it all the time. You know, I find a lot of difficulty with digs. I just sometimes cannot read digs at all. They invoke the CAPTCHA if you try to enter your password and fail once, then they want to make sure you're not a machine.
Okay, that sort of makes sense.
Yeah.
In fact, one of the things I want to talk about here is this notion of the cost of CAPTCHAs, because it's very interesting. I want to make sure that people know that the show notes for this episode has a bunch of links. Wikipedia has an excellent page on CAPTCHAs, lots of coverage, lots of good references. And on the show notes for this episode, episode 101, I found some interesting CAPTCHA cracking sites that have really good technology for and pictures of many popular CAPTCHAs showing, you know, basically what it is about them that isn't hard enough. And there are some CAPTCHAs that have solved at 100%, some at 88 or 89, meaning that algorithms have been created which are specifically designed to, you know, crack the visual complexity that people have put into these things in order to, again, differentiate between human and computer. The problem, of course, is that, as I said, this is the best set of puzzles or problems that we've so far been able to come up with. But the problem is computers have gotten so powerful and so good that there's a very fuzzy line between computer and human. Looking at these CAPTCHA cracking sites, and specifically at the complaints the authors of these crackers have, they say, for example, using a constant font or even a small number of fonts allowed them to do a better job of cracking the CAPTCHA.
Interesting, huh?
Or using all aligned or almost aligned characters allowed them to sort of, you know, analyze the characters and lock on to the relative alignment, and that was an aid to them.
Huh.
Or using constant character position. There are some CAPTCHA generators that produce images where the characters are like scattered around, but they're always scattered around in exactly the same location from one CAPTCHA to the next. So somebody trying to deliberately crack a capture-protected site would take advantage of the fact that, yeah, the characters are all kind of, you know, cattywampus, but they're always in the same cattywampus position. So once the author of a cracker saw that by looking at several captures being generated by that site, they'd go, oh, well, sure. And what's interesting is there's a perfect example of a mistake by the capture maker, because here you've made it really more difficult for the human, but because you know, we're just encountering that capture probably once, but here a spammer, it has essentially what you've done is you've made it harder for the human by scattering the characters around, but someone cracking the capture, writing code to crack it, once they recognize that the characters are always in exactly the same position with the same orientation, well, you've made it no more difficult for the code while making it while keeping it difficult for the human. So that was, you know, a bad idea.
Yeah.
Not to move them around. Also, constant horizontal position, constant character rotation, no deformation, non-textured background. The use of constant colors or weak colors, that's easier than for the cracking author to lock onto, or no overall perturbation of the image. So essentially what this means is that everything that is being done to make these things difficult for us does to some varying degree make it difficult for a program, but unfortunately we're seeing now that captures are, to some degree, being able to be broken. Now, other sites have analyzed what it is that is the most difficult for computers to solve, and that is in terms of cracking these images. And it turns out that dividing the individual glyphs, you know, glyph is the font term for an individual character, essentially. So dividing these images into individual characters is something that we do pretty well, but that's one of the problems that computers have. And so, for example, running lines through the characters really does bump the level of difficulty for automated recognition of the characters up rather substantially. And so one of the things you will see in the most modern CAPTCHA technologies are words or phrases or sequences of letters and numbers which end up being obscured with lines running through them, and maybe not so much other wacky stuff that makes it really difficult for people. I mean, again, Leo, I've run across CAPTCHAs where I'm thinking, okay, am I going to be punished if I get this wrong? Because I don't know if this is a Q or a bent over R. I mean,
but you make an interesting point that sometimes what's hard for a human is actually not hard for a machine.
Right. It's exactly. It's not always the case that what someone, a clever programmer, has actually done something that is making it more difficult for a machine, because what you're generally having, and this is a function of value, which is one of the key points I want to make today also, is, you know, the capture protecting Yahoo, because Yahoo has a high cracking value, you might very well have somebody who is willing to spend a great deal of time and effort writing a Yahoo CAPTCHA cracking technology, whereas, you know, some obscure, off the beaten path blogging site,
right,
which has never had a problem with malicious posting to it. Well, putting an extreme CAPTCHA on that site is extreme. Exactly. Here you're hoping somebody is going to put a comment on your blog posting. Well, raising the bar up too high for that poor human who's like, okay, do I have to stand on my head in order to decrypt this? You know, what is this CAPTCHA trying to say?
I have to say, though, it's so frustrating when you get spammed that sometimes you just say, screw it, I don't care if it's hard for humans. I'm not going to let the spammer in.
Right.
You wouldn't believe, I actually have turned off registrations on Twit TV because these guys will go to the extreme trouble of creating an email account signing up, waiting for me to send them the password via the verified email account, and then spamming. So it's very, you know, it's a lot of effort they're putting in. And it's, you know, compared to how hard it is for me to block them, it's not very hard for me to block them. I just have to constantly be doing it. And I finally just gave up. They were so relentless.
Resistant.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I understand why people might put really difficult captures.
Well, there have been some very, very clever hacks. And I think one of my very favorite most clever hacks, and this was done as a proof of concept, actually by somebody at CMU who was working sort of on the opposition team. I mean, he was on the side of CMU, and these have been, you know, major CAPTCHA innovators over the years. And we're going to talk about a recent, very cool concept that they came out with. But in any, you know, in any environment, you want somebody trying to break your solution. And, you know, in the academic environment, there were some people who said, I know how to break the whole CAPTCHA system. What they did was they created, or maybe they just borrowed or used, but anyway, there was an adult website that had very high traffic. And what they did was they created a system which imagine going to Yahoo and wanting to create an account. You're presented with a CAPTCHA. On the fly, this bot took that CAPTCHA and stuck it on the login page on the adult website where a human would solve the CAPTCHA problem.
Oh, no.
So the bot would then take the human solution and feed it back to Yahoo, thus solving Yahoo's original CAPTCHA problem. Isn't that just the cleverest thing?
They basically used unwitting human helpers.
Yes.
By just borrowing Yahoo's CAPTCHAs and keeping track of them.
Exactly. There was enough traffic on the site that is on the adult website that no CAPTCHA would remain unsolved for long.
Wow.
And so it fit within the window of time that Yahoo was allowing that CAPTCHA to be valid. So on the fly, Yahoo CAPTCHAs would be, or you know, I would imagine the way it would work is this. You would actually be, you know, I'm just thinking of this on the fly here, you would actually have your bot on the adult website. You would wait till they were presented with a puzzle. Or maybe, yes, you go to the adult website and it says, click here to log in.
Right. And meanwhile, it goes out to Yahoo and gets a CAPTCHA.
Exactly. When the person on the adult website clicks here to log in, it's about to present him with a CAPTCHA. So the bot goes to Yahoo, clicks to create an account, receives the CAPTCHA, forwards it to the adult site that then presents that CAPTCHA to the human who solves the CAPTCHA problem, and then the bot turns around, solves the problem on Yahoo, and is able to create an email account. So I just, you know, that's super clever, and I just thought that was, you know, a neat solution.
It's also depressing because it really means it's hopeless. I don't know how you
exactly.
get around
like,
that. I mean,
yeah, exactly. Now what are we going to do?
Now what do we do? Yeah. Because you're essentially, I mean, you can't get around the fact that they can enlist humans, as long as they're willing to enlist humans, to do this.
Yes, exactly. And that, by the way, is known in the CAPTCHA community as the so-called relay attack, where you're relaying the CAPTCHA through a site where you've got enough traffic in order to, you know, to generate a useful number of CAPTCHA solution events on the fly. And again, you know, what are you going to do about it? Now, CAPTCHA is a little bit controversial also, and I have a link on our show notes to the W3Cs, you know, the W3 Consortium's anti-CAPTCHA page. It's they just don't like CAPTCHA because they feel that it very unfairly discriminates against people who have any kind of disabilities, and, you know, they're all about, and they want the web to be all about being a non-discriminatory system. And they make the point that even if you have, and you talked about this before, Leo, the notion of an audio CAPTCHA, that is the idea being your main CAPTCHA is a visual CAPTCHA where you've got to figure out what this phrase or expression is. But For blind people, of course, they're not going to be able to do that. So you have a backup solution, which is, you know, click on this to hear something.
I'm going to play. This is the one.
J.
This is.
T.
This is Diggs. That, you know, the truth was that wasn't. I wouldn't think a machine would have that much trouble.
Well,
F. J. T. N.
It's actually easier than doing it, looking at it. I'm going to use the listen to it from now on.
It actually is.
Yeah.
Now,
I played the Carnegie Mellon for you before. You want to hear that one?
Sure.
This is the audio attempt to make an audio version of a CAPTCHA.
4-1-6.
That would be tough for a machine.
Was that 416?
I guess.
I think. And see, here's the problem, is that we also have speech recognition. I mean, we've been working on that for a long time in this, you know, in the computer community, in the same way that we've been working on optical character recognition and vision technologies. So, unfortunately, the audio backup for the visual capture also has to be deliberately obscured in order to make it, again, difficult for a computer. And unfortunately, there just isn't enough difference today between computer recognition of audio and human recognition of audio for this to be a really great solution. But the W3C page makes the point that even doing this discriminates because it's a privacy problem. Now you're forcing blind people, people who are not sighted, to declare themselves as such on a site. And you could argue that that is some loss of privacy because they're not able to solve the visual CAPTCHA. They're being forced to solve the auditory CAPTCHA. Anyway,
I think that's a little speculous, but
I know, but the W3C page does it's very anti-CAPTCHA and it makes a number of points.
I would be more aggressive in defending CAPTCHA, but it sounds like from what you've just described, it doesn't work that well anyway, or doesn't necessarily work that well. So maybe it's not worth defending.
Well, there are problems with it. Now, one of the coolest things you turned me on to a couple weeks ago, you just sent me a link in email, Leo, and you said, "Isn't this neat?" And it is just, again, I love clever stuff, and I love sharing cleverness with people. And this, of course, is known as ReCAPTCHA. And this, again, is from it's from our same guy, Van Ahn,
yep.
at CMU. He recognized that there's a huge effort underway to digitize books. We are wanting to get books into digital form rather than just scanning them and then like presenting scanned pages. People can read scanned pages more or less. The problem is that a scanned page is a huge amount of data compared to a typewritten page. And if we actually have it converted to text, then it could be ebook, it can be, you know, you can use text-to-speech in order to automate the process of reading the book audibly. I mean, it's just so much cooler to have these books in electronic form. I mean, in textual, you know, ASCII-style electronic form as opposed to scanned images. But many books were published, well, I'm sure it's probably most books, were published before we had the technology to do it all electronically. So there is no original, you know, doc file or text file to back up these books. So here we've got this huge archive of scanned images. Well, the cleverness of ReCAPTCHA is of using single word snippets from scanned texts and presenting those to users. So in the process of solving the CAPTCHA puzzle, you are part of the solution of digitizing these books.
I just think it's so elegant. And by the way, I use that if people want to send me emails. So I have the same. Now here's an example of why you might want to use a CAPTCHA. I'm not going to put an email link on my front page, although at this point it's pretty moot since I think I'm on every spam mailing list in the world. But I thought, well, why make it any worse? So I do have a contact link, but in order to get the email address, you have to fill out a CAPTCHA. And I'm using the CMU CAPTCHA. So if you go to leoville.com or techguylabs.com, you click Contact Leo, you'll get a CAPTCHA. And in the process, so do you want to describe how it works? It's very cool. There's two words you get.
Yes. What they do is they show you two words. These are both, these were both.
They're both English words.
They're both English words. They were also originally flagged as unrecognizable by the OCR software.
So these are books they're trying to scan, but they've had some trouble with.
Well, these are individual words from books they've tried to scan.
Mm-hmm.
One of the cool things about OCR, contemporary OCR software, is it knows if it's not sure. That is, it knows if it's like, I really don't feel confident. You know, you now get a confidence factor per word from OCR software, or at least this particular OCR software that's being used. So here's the cool thing. The word starts out as being unrecognizable with high confidence by the best OCR software we have. So that's a good start at something which, you know, no one else's OCR software is going to be able to recognize either. Then it is deliberately warped and a wavy line is run through it. And as we learned, a wavy line it now means that instead of having little islands of glyph which are easily identified and then can be chopped up and recognized individually, this turns it into one big blob of black, and it turns out that it really hurts recognition, but not for humans. Humans don't have a problem with that. And so the idea then is that two words are presented to you, and you're asked to type them both in. Well, you're not the only person who receives this pair of words. Enough people receive different combinations of them that by comparing what people put in, the back end software that is doing all this is able to arrive at a high enough confidence level that, you know, I don't know what their numbers are, but maybe 10 people all put in the same text for each of the two words appearing at different times in different contexts and in different pairs, that they finally said, okay, we now know for sure what this word is. So not only have you proven yourself to be human, but you've also helped OCR software digitize books.
And I think it's just so cool.
I love it.
In fact, even if I didn't really need it, I would still use it. Just to do my part, right?
Yes. And now, it is estimated that 60 million CAPTCHAs are currently, visual CAPTCHAs, are currently being solved by humans every day.
Wow.
And that about 10 seconds or so of time is required for the typical CAPTCHA to be looked at and typed in.
Well, that's a lot of computing time.
So 10 seconds times 60 million a day is 600 million thought seconds per day, which is to say 166 plus 1,000 hours.
Jeez.
So 166,000 hours are being spent now solving CAPTCHAs.
Each day.
Each day. So by using ReCAPTCHA, that can be turned into 166,000 hours of people distributed over the entire world digitizing books.
I think that's great. I would love to see what the results are so far with this project. I think that's just wonderful.
So I want to commend people to take a look at ReCAPTCHA. It's just www. If you go to CAPTCHA.net, www.CAPTCHA.net, it now recommends ReCAPTCHA, and ReCAPTCHA is just the same with an RE on the front of it.
Trivially and easy to add to a website. You'll generate it, you'll create a link, and boom, it's done. And by the way, they talk about the pornography attack and the other, this is really interesting how they're doing it. They point to a lot of the information that you've been talking about.
Right. Now, one other, you know, there are other things that have been done. In general, solving, that is to say, have been done as non-visual means or non-CAPTCHA. Well, I guess CAPTCHA actually would encompass everything because it's a computer, blah, 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 whatever that acronym was. But, you know, so anything that is trying to differentiate a person from a computer. So we have, you know, the visual CAPTCHAs we've been talking about. But, for example, you could imagine some sort of puzzle-solving solution. There has been JavaScript created which asks simple English language problems, like what is, you know, 1 plus 1 as a trivial example. The problem is, again, it wouldn't be hard to cause a computer to have, you know, there'd be a limited enough vocabulary of permutations of questions that different numbers would get plugged into that you could write some code that would, you know, understand that limited subset of questions and be able to answer them. So that's not very exciting. Then, and you mentioned this, I think, last week or the week before, there was this interesting notion of something called KittenAuth. KittenAuth was created a couple of years ago. The idea was it would show you a grid of photos,
right,
some of which were kittens, and you'd have to select those which were kittens and then click OK. The idea, again, being that only a person would be able to actually recognize what this was a photo of and whether or not it was a kitten, and be able to answer it correctly. The problem is you would have a limited number of pictures, and given somebody who was motivated enough to crack this form of CAPTCHA, they would simply, you know, capture all the pictures, flag them as kittens or non-kittens, and then be able to hack right through. So that's not going to work very well.
Right.
And the other thing is that CMU comments that actually isn't a CAPTCHA by their definition. They want it to be a fully automated creation. That is, you're having to take actual photos, and that you're going to have a limited database of those. You're not actually synthesizing something from scratch, which is what these visual, alphanumeric CAPTCHAs are doing, is they're building the image from scratch, and you don't have a limited domain of images from which to choose, or again, that would be very easy to hack. So then another thing that's been suggested is somehow involve live operators, where, you know, you involve a human in the loop, sort of hearkening back to the original Turing test, where you did have a human making the determination.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a whole domain of what we were talking about when we were talking about multi-factor authentication, where you have specific ID authentication. That is, you're no longer determining whether the person, an anonymous person, is a person or a human, but you're saying, you know, you're using single sign-on, you're using authentication like OpenID or CardSpace or something to say, okay, you know, this is exactly who you are. Maybe you're using, public key infrastructure for doing, for example, you know, you using certificate authentication or biometrics. So it's like, okay, you know, computers don't have thumbprints, although you can certainly imagine that computers could just create a fake thumbprint. So, you know, those things seem, you know, not so useful that is, but, you know, they've been experimented with. And then there's also, you know, simple questions being asked, you know, variations on, you know, like five words, and the question is, you know, which one of these does not have a sale? And the problem, again, is you're probably going to have a limited number of questions, which after a while, all of those can be automated in order to crack the response. So it turns out that this is a hard problem. Like I said, it's, you think right off the bat, the first time you encounter it, is like, oh, how interesting. Shouldn't it be easy to tell people and humans apart? But over an internet connection, it's not so easy.
Not so easy. Yeah, very clever.
Now, and then when you add this notion of a relay attack, where you've got people solving the same problem for a different reason, then it's like, oh, very clever, and now what do we do?
Yeah, yeah. Well, they claim that the recapture is not susceptible to that. I'm not sure what – I haven't read it, so I'm not sure what
– they've got a bunch of crypto involved, where they use multiple servers, and you are – it's all free, but you get some tags that you use as part of this. And so they are specifically working to eliminate – to eliminate. And limit – I was trying to say eliminate and or limit – that vulnerability.
Yeah, very interesting. Well, that's CAPTCHAs. That's how to tell if you're a human. Are you human?
Okay, Leo, now you got to do this. https://www.paypal.com/securitykey.
Ah, okay.
See if that comes up for you. and I put in PayPal security key into Google, it's the first link that comes up. Because
okay.
This is just so cool for $5. And it just, I mean, $5.
Oh, there
to
it is, yeah.
Yeah.
All right, order your security key. I don't know why it's not showing up on my front page, but that's great. Oh, I got to log in. All right. And so now you use this every time you use PayPal now?
Yeah, and I forgot to mention also eBay. It provides security for eBay as well.
Yeah, because they're owned by the same. See, $5, what a deal. I'm sending it right now.
I know, $5. I mean, you know, who doesn't want to have one of these cool crypto tokens for $5? Anyway, I want to make sure people knew, because then after you authenticate this to your account, you simply add, and you must add, those six digits that currently shows to the end of your password.
That's
in
brilliant.
Order to log on to and to PayPal or eBay. And I'm just so jazzed.
That's just
about
brilliant.
This.
Well, we use PayPal heavily, and I am always a little nervous because I keep all of our receipts from the Twit Network in there. And I'm almost using it as a banking account because you earn interest on it. So I feel like, well, that's a safe place to keep it. But, boy, we could be wiped out if I weren't careful with the password. So this makes me feel a lot better.
It is safer now.
Yeah, because, for instance, our hosting draws directly from that account. All of our overhead pretty much comes directly from that account. So if it were to suddenly go to zero balance, I don't want to think about it.
I would not want to encourage people to create a bogus PayPal account just to get a $5 token. But
no.
You could, and it's very cool.
Well, you know, if you're gonna, here's a way to do it: make a donation to Twit. As part of that, you could set up an account. You don't have to tie it to your bank account. You can use a credit card, so you don't have to feel like you're, you know, somehow giving them something private. I think that's one thing that scares people. Just sign up, give us a little donation, help the podcast to stay afloat, and then your little benefit is you get that $5 security key and be more secure. I like it.
It's just too cool, Leo.
Yeah, I just ordered it.
Cool.
All right, Steve. Boy, this is a long episode. We had a lot
mailbag
to say.
Mailbag is next week, so I want to again say securitynow@grc.com. That is mail that comes directly to me through no spam filtering or anything else. The web form at the bottom of the Security Now page at grc.com sends email to the same address. It does so anonymously unless you provide, you know, your name and location and email and so forth, which does allow me to respond when I'm able to, and I'd like to when I can. But anyone who just wants to do an easier way can just send email to securitynow@grc.com.
Excellent.
And we'll do mailbag next week.
Excellent. All right, Steve, we'll see you next week. Thanks for joining us on Security Now.
Security Now.